A question that comes up from time to time with members is the question about predestination. And so we'll seek to answer that question today. And we're going to look at how God interacts with humanity historically and personally. And predestination is the belief that God preordains events and people. God preordains events and people. And, for instance, I know that, there's something called kismet. Well, the reason we got together was kismet, or God meant for us to be together. And that you're my, and different versions of that, especially a lot of love stories relate to that kind of thing. But let's see if it applies in Christianity. So how does the questions that follow that particular idea of predestination, and predestination, or the word is translated as predestination in the Bible, and how does God preordain events and people? Do any of us have any choices at all if it's all preordained? If there is free will, how much are we allowed to express it? Do we have free will? And how much does God interact with free will? Does God prevent you from having free will? Are human beings predestined to go to eternal punishment and eternal life? So God has predestined that. For 2,000 years in Christianity, it has been the belief that from the foundation of the world, before any human being existed, God picked the ones who are going to hell and those who are going to heaven. It's been predetermined. It's predetermined, and there's nothing you can do to change it. It's already been worked out. And, that particular view has changed to a degree in the last 200 years. Another question that comes from this is, why did God allow human beings to be exposed to evil? Why would he even do that? Why would God allow that to happen? And can a person resist God's grace? Can a person resist God's grace? There is the concept in Christianity, especially among evangelical Christians, something called irresistible grace. And the idea is that once God gives his grace to somebody, that person can't stop it. Can't stop it. And can a person resist God's grace, or is God's grace irresistible? And does God set up every ruler over every nation? How much is God involved in the world around us? Why doesn't God intervene? And, that leads to questions like, why doesn't God intervene? Why doesn't God stop things? Why does God allow evil people to take over governments? Is he powerless? Does he have power to raise up and take down? We'll answer those questions as we go through the study on predestination this afternoon. So I'm going to take time to go through some pretty simple material, and we want to go through this because it lays the groundwork where we get into more detail on the subject of predestination. But there are certain things that we need to understand about how God interacts with human beings. How does he do that? Let's take a look at that and seek to understand it. And as we go through it, we're going to be in the Old Testament quite a bit. And the reason we're going to be in the Old Testament is because there are a number of profound statements that are made in the Old Testament that impact this subject. So to begin, let's go to Isaiah chapter 42. Isaiah chapter 42, and this tells us certain basic things about God and the way that he operates. Isaiah chapter 42, verse 5. Isaiah chapter 42, verse 5. It says, thus says God, the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk on it. And God brought it all into being. He created them all. And God's telling us there that he is the creator, that nothing exists without him. and He's in control of everything. Now, the next couple of verses, verses 6 and 7, talk about the Messiah. It says, I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness and will hold your hand. I will keep you and give you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the Gentiles. So that is the Messiah. He is going to be a light to the Gentiles. He will be a covenant to the people. Verse 7, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the prison, those who sit in darkness from the prison house. God is going to open the prison for them. And he's saying here in verse 8, he says, I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to be to carved images. So you can carve an image, but you know that image means nothing. It is not God. It's not God. So he's telling us that he is the creator of the world, and he's telling us that he's going to send the Messiah, and the Messiah is going to fix things. Even the concept of the covenant, which is mentioned there, has to do with predestination. So God is the creator. He's sending the Messiah. He's going to fix things. So here's the starting point of who God is. He is the creator. He is the ruler. He's going to fix things. He's going to tell us of those things before they happen. So that's where we start our discussion of predestination. We accept what it says here, and all of us here believe that God is the ultimate good. There is no evil in God. And we can talk about that there are actually things that God cannot do. Are there things that God cannot do? Actually, there are. For example, God cannot lie. God cannot lie. And the Bible tells us that clearly. God's character is such that he can't lie. He won't lie. God cannot sin. And if God were to compromise on matters of character, the universe would be in a sorry, sorry shape. But God will not compromise on matters of character. And, if God allowed the evil to prevail, you know, the world that would ensue would be a terrible world, and death would be preferable to life. But thankfully, God cannot be evil. And we accept that, and we account on that. And God wills that. God chooses the way of character always. And he wills that there are certain things that he will not do. He will not do them. His will is set, and it will not change, which is fortunate for us. We believe, therefore, that God is the ultimate love. That brings us to a question. If God is this sovereign ruler and creator of the universe, and he is the ultimate good and love, why did God allow human beings to be exposed to evil? If he's the ultimate good, why did he allow human beings to be exposed to evil? Because we know that evil is a part of our world, don't we? Sadly, it is. And there's only one conclusion that we can reach. We have to believe it was best for human beings, as part of God's plan, to be exposed to evil. God said that as in the working out of my plan and bringing many sons to glory, it is best that human beings be exposed to evil. So that's how God ordained it. If God truly loves us, he wants the best for us. And looking at things from the perspective of eternal life, it is best that we be exposed to evil. We must either accept it or reject it as human beings. And it is best for us to be in the flesh and be exposed to evil and to choose to accept or reject it. So God has placed us into this world, and he said, you're going to be exposed to evil. It's just like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and they were exposed to evil. And God allowed that to take place. And it was for their ultimate betterment. So we have to accept that God has allowed this. And if you don't accept that God has allowed evil to be a part of the world. Not that he wants us to give into it, but it is a part of it. We have to be exposed to it, and we have to make a choice. If we have to accept that that is a true premise. If that premise is not accepted, the issue of predestination becomes very difficult. It basically becomes a minefield. As we look at how many of you have heard of a group called the Calvinists? You know, I think they're known as Presbyterians. John Calvin, from him came the Presbyterians. And Calvinists hold a view that is like this. When God created all human beings, he created their souls before we became human beings. So God created all of the souls. They were all spirit. All these spirits were created. And so all of the souls pre-existed the flesh. I don't know where they draw that conclusion from, but they do draw it. And sin is part of all human beings, so human nature is corrupt. Therefore, God looked down at all the souls and arbitrarily chose those who would be saved and those who would be condemned to eternal life. So the choice could not be based on human effort. God made the choice. Well, you're going to receive eternal life, and you're going to receive death. And it was just a choice. It had nothing to do with what they did or they didn't do. And so God deliberately made choices about who would be saved and who would be lost forever. Interestingly, based upon that, some of the most despicable human beings that have ever lived are God's going to save to prove how great he is. And some of the good people that are trying to be good and do what's right, they're going to be condemned to the lake of fire or hell because it's his choice. Now, if anybody sees a problem with that, I see a problem with that. That doesn't seem, you know, fairness is important, and I don't see that as fair. God's making these arbitrary choices just to show his greatness. I don't think that's the God that I worship. So that's a minefield and isn't biblical at all, but that's how a lot of people think. But if we look at this and we believe that God is the ultimate good, we have to accept that exposure to evil was for our good. And we either accept that or we have to believe that Satan put something over on God. Ha! I got the better of God. No, he didn't. God is allowing Satan to be a part of the what's going on here. He allows it, and it's for the ultimate good of all of us. And that's an important thing to understand. So the exposure to evil had to be for our good. He didn't cause us to do evil. He didn't expose us to evil himself, but he allowed Adam and Eve to be exposed to evil. And we have to ask why. Why is that? Why did he allow them to be exposed? Let's go back to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. And here we see another picture which speaks of God's interactions with the world through history. And I'm going to show you an instance where God did interact in history. And you'll be able to see a little bit how this starts to come into focus. So Paul is the one who's involved here in Acts 17, and he's speaking to people who are constantly involved in philosophical discussion. They were Athenians, and philosophy and all that goes with that, and the debating was all part of that. And they're speculating on good and evil, speculating on God and the ultimate good. Let's go to chapter 17 and look at verse 23. So Paul, let's just start in verse 22. Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious." And they were. They were religious people. "For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.'" So Paul made note of that. the unknown God, and they used plaques to set up the unknown God to reach the people there in Athens. So these plaques were found around there. And Paul says, "Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you." So he found a way that he could reach these people. The unknown God was established as a result of a plague that broke out in the city of Athens. So they're wondering, how can they get rid of this plague? So they sacrifice to all the known gods. They sacrifice to all the known gods, and yet the plague continued on. So in their sacrifices, they weren't able to placate whoever the god was that was causing this. Finally, they decided to send out a flock of sheep, and wherever the sheep chose to stop, they made sacrifice. They made a sacrifice of that sheep to the unknown god. So if that sheep stopped to eat, then they determined, well, that must be to this god, and they made sacrifice of the sheep, and if that didn't work, then they allowed it, sent out another sheep. The plague was stopped eventually, and plaques were set up wherever the sacrifice had been made. So this was what Paul noted, the shrine to the unknown god, and he used this as a way to reach the people. Verse 24, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. So he's pointing out that this unknown God that they don't know does not dwell in temples made with hands. He is the sovereign king, the ruler. The universe is his creation and responsibility, and he has all power to do whatever he wants. Verse 25. God who made the world and everything in it, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. So, you know what? God has determined where people go and where nations are formed, and God is the one who set all of that up. As he says there, and he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and boundaries of their dwellings. So God has determined all of that. And verse 27, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said. For we are also his offspring. So he's quoting their poets, something that they would be familiar with in order to make a point to them. Verse 29, therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. So he's making this point to them, and the people say, you know, he makes sense. He makes sense. And the reason why he was making sense was he was quoting their own philosophers to them. And those philosophers had come to see that something was wrong with idolatry. It didn't answer the questions. It didn't take care of important issues that came about in life. For if God is the ultimate good, how can we make statues of him? Paganism at this particular time was going through some difficult times. And they were finding that paganism didn't work. It didn't live up to its promises. And Paul is giving them a solution. He declares the sovereignty of God. So we have the passage from Isaiah and the passage from Paul. Now let's look at an instance where these concepts play out. And we find that in Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4. And Daniel has interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's first dream. And even though he's interpreted it and been wowed by the fact that God revealed the meaning of the dream and the meaning of the dream to him, he's still a very prideful, a very self-absorbed individual and he thought of himself much more highly than he should have. Nebuchadnezzar felt that his power was his own. He was the one who had taken over and expanded the Babylonian world into the greatest empire the world had ever known to that time. And he saw himself as a source of might and power. And what we are going to find here in chapter 4 is a proclamation from the king himself to his empire. Let's go to Daniel 4, verses 1 through 3. Daniel 4, verses 1 through 3. So Nebuchadnezzar, this is a message from the Nebuchadnezzar the king, beginning in verse 1, to all people, nations, and languages that dwell in the earth, peace be multiplied to you. He said, I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are His signs and how mighty are His wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and His dominion is from generation to generation. So he's going to go on and describe a dream that he had, a dream that none of his soothsayers or magicians were able to explain. And he had already been through it with Daniel. Daniel had come and had explained the dream that he had had. So he calls on Daniel once again. And Daniel tells him that God gave him the dream. Chapter 4, verse 24. Daniel 4, verse 24. It says, this is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. So he's telling them that you are, yes, you think you are a mighty man. And that's how he saw himself. I am the mightiest man in the world. I have all power and wealth. And he hadn't learned anything from his first dream. So he thinks very highly of himself. So Daniel told him that that this was going to play out. And he's going to learn that God had set him up and God could take him down. He was going to learn a very important lesson, which lots and lots of rulers that have thought of themselves very highly, I think, have gone through things and learned this lesson. Some probably still have to learn it. Let's go down to chapter 28, or chapter 4, verse 28. There it says, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. So God's warned him. You need to humble yourself instead of seek to exalt yourself. The king spoke, saying, he's looking out there and he's thinking, what a spectacular city I live in. It's the most beautiful city in the world. I have this extensive empire. Look at all of this. I have made Babylon. It's all mine and I've accomplished it all. So while he's thinking all these things and thinking of how exalted that he is, the king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? And while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. So they, just as God had told him, they drove him out from the kingdom. And he lived as an animal for 7 years. Lived as an animal for 7 years. And basically lost his mind for that time. Verse 34, it says in here. It says, and at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who lives forever. For in His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain His hand or say to Him, what have you done? So he saw his place in the scheme of things, and this God that Daniel worshipped was a God that was supreme. And so God gave him some insight into how things work. He could say, you are God, Daniel's God is God, and I am not. And God then gave him back his kingdom. And so we see how God interacts with human history. God can bring people down and he can raise them up. And this brings us to a dilemma in terms of how God interacts with history. Does God set up every ruler over every kingdom all the time throughout history? So is God going to set up in our country Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? Which one is he going to set up? How do you know that he set one of those individuals up? We don't know. Did God set up Adolf Hitler? Did he set up Saddam Hussein? Did he set up Vladimir Putin? Or did other things take place? How do we explain a loving God working in a democracy? Does that mean at any given time he has to work through millions of people to achieve his will, to get tens of millions of people to vote the way he wants? Is that how it works? So I'm going to influence everybody to elect a Democrat or everybody to elect a Republican. Is that how it works? How do we explain if God sets up all kingdoms and nations, sets all their boundaries, how do we explain all the evil throughout those kingdoms and nations down through history? Wars and oppression. How do we explain all that? You know, I read a biography of Napoleon, and it was quite interesting. He's an interesting individual, but all the people, the flower of France, were wiped out in all of the wars that they got involved in. And they happily marched after him. They did eventually get tired of it and say, okay, that's enough. But I mean, thousands and thousands of Frenchmen died. And, did God set him up and allow him to, God allowed him to rule, of course. Two things that we need to understand in all of this is, first of all, free will. Free will. Every human being has free will. They have the ability to choose good and evil. And the problem with free will is that you really have to have a choice. You have to have a choice. If you give someone nothing but good and say, make a choice. If there's only good, make a choice. Well, there's only one choice. But God didn't do that. He said there's good and there's evil. There's the tree of life. There's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You have a choice and you have to make a choice. You can't say, well, I'm not going to make a choice. No, when you don't make a choice, you're still making a choice. You have to make a choice. As you look at Adam and Eve and you look at their story, and God talks about the garden and he talks about creating it and he talks about putting the man and woman in there. And he said, here's the tree of life. Here's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You must choose. So choose life. That's what God said. That's what God wanted them to do. Choose life. But if you choose the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you're going to die. There's an outcome to that that is most negative. Don't choose that tree. But he gave them a choice. And that's what God has given all of us. They had the choice to obey God's will, and God told them what his will was. And they chose to disregard that. God commanded the man, and God was very clear on what the command was. As you read through Genesis 2, is there any doubt about the choice? And the fact that if you chose wrongly, you're going to suffer. It's very clear. And God told them, don't do this. If you don't follow my command, things will get really bad. And if you choose to exercise your free will apart from me, there are consequences, and there most certainly were, and still are. But free will is essential to what God wants us to become. You have to choose. You can say, well, why didn't God just make us spirit beings? And say, you're going to live forever, and you're going to have this character already programmed into you. Now, God could have done that, but God said, that's not what I want. I want to build a family, and I want people to be a part of my family because they have made a conscious choice to reject evil and sin and to choose life. So nobody's going to be forced to be a part of God's kingdom, God's family. It's going to be a choice. And everybody that is there is going to say, I responded to God and I chose the tree of life. Nobody's going to say, well, God forced me to do it. I really didn't want to do it. If you think that, you're not going to be there. So God gave them that choice. And any concept of predestination that does away with free will is not true. Because predestination says you didn't have any choice. You were predestined to this outcome. And that automatically denies the principle of you have a choice. You have free will. Isn't that right? So it can't be both ways. It's got to be one way or the other. And God clearly tells you that as human beings, you have a choice. I want you to make the right choice, but I'm not going to force you to make a choice. You have a choice. As you go through the subject of free will, we can see that God put limitations on himself in order that we can exercise free will. And by God allowing us to exercise free will, it cost him something. He had to say, okay, if I do this, it's going to cost me something. There's going to be a price that I'm going to have to pay if I allow them free will. It's going to cost me something. But God said, you know what? It's worth it to have to pay the price and to see the ultimate outcome of that choice and that price being paid. It's worth it. The outcome is so wonderful, it's worth it, and I'm willing to pay it. For the ultimate good to take place, God is willing to suffer. And why is that? Because he's willed himself to do so. I'm willing to suffer for my creation. I'm willing to suffer so that they can have eternal life. I'm willing to pay the price for their sins, which they can't pay. As you look at, let's go to Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, and you see here the first bad attitude. Genesis chapter 4. Many bad attitudes have followed, but Cain's attitude was just not, it stunk. We go to Genesis chapter 4 and look at verses 5 and 6. Cain brought his offering. It was not what God had commanded them to bring as a sacrifice for sin. And God said, I don't respect what you brought, Cain. And Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. So when God said, that's not what I asked you to bring. Blood must be sacrificed in order to cover sin. Berries and fruits and all of that and grain, that's all nice, but that's never going to pay the price for sin. It does not illustrate the point that I'm trying to make to you. So I don't accept that. And his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you so angry? And why has your countenance fallen? You mean Cain didn't know what to bring? He did. He just didn't do it. I'm not going to do it. I don't want to do it that way. I want to do it my way. So they probably could have played Frank Sinatra's song, I Did It My Way. And he did. And God tells him, if you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do what I ask you to do, isn't it going to be well with you? Am I not going to think highly of you for that? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door. And its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. You have a choice. You have a choice. Sin is there. It's tempting you. It's drawing you to it. It wants you to give in to it. And you have a choice whether you're going to give in to it or not. Isn't that right? You have a choice. You know, when we face, we're in a situation where we become angry or we're upset, we have a choice, don't we, as to how we're going to respond. Or if we're going to respond at all. Don't we have a choice? The question is, how will we respond? It's a choice. So I can do this in a way that is pleasing to God, or I can go with my human nature. Which am I going to do? Which am I going to do? There is a choice. And Cain had a choice, but he made a bad choice. God corrected him for it, and he didn't accept the correction very well. And clearly, God made the point that Cain had a choice. From Adam and Eve onward, you have men and women repeatedly making wrong choices over and over and over again. And what happens to humanity as it continues to make choices that move it as a whole further away from God? So Cain makes his bad choice, and he continues making bad choices over and over and over again. And you know what happened? He's having children. And he's showing them how to make bad choices. He's cussing them. He's beating them. He's abusing his wife. He's willing to murder. Whatever it takes, he's doing it. And they're seeing all of this unfold, and everybody is following down the same path, especially from his family. And you had a different line, the line of Seth, and that line was more righteous. But unfortunately, they, as time went along, became corrupted. And basically the world became such that man's thoughts were only evil continually. So there was only a little good sprinkled in here and there. You know, things are, you know, we're moving in the direction of Noah's time, and there is some good out there. But you know, sadly, the evil is overwhelming the good. And it is worse than it used to be. It is worse than it used to be. So it came to be that every intent of the mind will be to choose the wrong and then to enjoy the wrong. And eventually there's very little room for good. And as God looked at this unfold, God was sorrowful that he had made mankind. I mean, as you look at your children who have gone awry, let's say, it's your child, and they've gone in the wrong direction, how many of you are saddened by that, hurt by that? It's your child. You want the best for them. And you know by the decisions they're making, they're hurting themselves. But they're not listening to you. And they keep on making the bad decisions. And you try to talk to them, don't do this because it's going to hurt you. And they said, you know what? You need to just stay out of my life. It's my business and I'm going to do it. What can you do? You know, I guess you could get the tranquilizer dart and take them out and take them home and lock them up. But is that the solution? No, sadly, you let them go and you suffer the pain of seeing what the decisions they make. And who wants to see their child, you know, an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever foolish things they've involved themselves in? And God was sorry for what had happened. And before the flood, man's ability to choose between good and evil had become so skewed toward evil that God had no choice but to destroy them. So at the end of the age, God is going to have to come back to stop the world from self-destructing. Isn't that what it tells us in Matthew 24? It said that unless God stepped in and stopped it, that man would destroy himself. There would be no flesh saved alive. We'd be back to Genesis 1, verse 2. Tohu and bohu. But God said, I don't want that. And so mankind is moving toward that state, sad to say. Now, it was Satan who deceived Eve. God didn't deceive her. God told her clearly what the answer to the question was of the two trees. Two trees, eat of this one, eat of the whole garden, including this one. But if you eat of that tree, you're dead. He told her very clearly. There was, you know, and she knew, Adam knew. And what was interesting is I heard a minister speaking, and I'd never thought of this. Obviously, you may have thought of it, but you know, I've always thought that Eve was there when Satan confronted her and gave her his pitch. But Adam wasn't there. But, you know, what's interesting, he believes Adam was right there with her. He was talking to her, and he went after her, and Adam He should have knocked it out of her hand or whatever. That's like you as a parent recognizing your child is going to get into trouble if they step out into the street. And you say, well, I'm going to let them make their own choice and see what happens. Instead of you grabbing the kid and saying, no, what are you doing? He should have just said, knocked it out of her hand or whatever and said, we're moving on. We're not going to get involved in this. But they made that decision. 2 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4. 2 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. You see, the gospel, as God opens your mind to it, is pretty simple. It's pretty simple. But unless God opens your mind, it's not so simple. It's veiled. It is veiled to a person. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. And then it talks about in verse 4, whose mind the God of this age has blinded. So Satan is at work in this world, and he has blinded the most people living in this age. Whose mind the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. And we know from Ephesians 2:2, he's called the prince of the power of the air. And what he's doing is he's broadcasting his mindset, his attitudes and temptations, and our minds are being bombarded by them, constantly. He's constantly looking for vulnerability, some way that he can get into your head and influence you. So when Satan deceived Adam and Eve, God didn't just say, well, it's no big deal. It's no big deal. I'll still work with you. No, that's not how God reacted. He said, you guys are out. You're out of the garden. And you can't come back into the garden. And I'm going to ensure that you can't by placing a cherub there. And so God kicked them out. And he told them, basically, if you want Satan to be your Lord and Master, you don't want to listen to me, fine. Have at it. And we'll see how it works out. The deception of the world is the problem that many people who examine predestination don't understand. The world is deceived. They have no choice, but the choice, they have a choice, but the choice isn't on a level playing field because they only see part of the picture. They don't see the whole picture. They don't see it. Choices are being made under a set of false assumptions and beliefs. Therefore, their choice isn't completely real. There is a God of this age, and God doesn't set up every king, every ruler, every person in power on the face of the earth. Because God is not acting as the God of this world. That's sometimes something we sometimes may not think about. God isn't the God of this world. Satan is the God of this world. And Satan is influencing the world. And he is a spirit being, and he is able to influence people with his spirit, the spirit of the world. And he does a wonderful, he's very good at it. And what God does do is sets things up and to make sure that his plan is carried out. And from the foundation of the world, God has had a plan. And he's allowed Satan to rule this world. And we can make all the wrong choices we want, but in the end, God's plan is going to be worked out without interfering with free will. God's going to intervene. God intervenes in our lives and in the world, but God's not going to stop free will. For instance, as you came, God opened your mind to the truth. All right, as you opened your mind to the truth, he did not take you over and say, you must be baptized. Did he do that? And you just basically were like, you know, how you see people that are demon-possessed, Satan takes them over and they're all crazy-eyed and they do crazy things. Is that what takes place? God takes you over and you have no choice. So you're fighting it and trying to resist it and the guy's going to put you under the water. That's not happening. I've had people resist being baptized, but the reason was because the water was freezing cold. Said, sorry, but you got to go under. It's not happened. And tried once, tried twice. Finally, I said, you got to do it. I don't want to do it. And it's too cold. And I said, well, I can't help that. So boom, there she went. So she did. And found out later that this person didn't actually like the church. And he had put the water in the tank and left it cold intentionally. This was years later. And I thought, what's up with that? So anyway, was beyond my control. So anyway, she was baptized, but I just thought, you know, it's cold. I don't want to go through it. I remember doing one baptism in a pool here in Houston, and it was cold. But basically, you just said, let's get in, get it on, get done with this, and get out, because it's too cold to stand around in here. But so God has a plan, and Satan's a part of that plan. God has allowed Satan to be a part of it, because he gives us his input, and we have to resist it and reject it. So God does put his finger in human history to keep things going in a certain direction. But God is not the God of this age. Satan is. And God does come along and put someone in power from time to time to keep the world from falling apart. But generally speaking, he tries to stay out of it. And God does not orchestrate events the grand majority of the time. The grand majority of the time, Satan, the demons, and human beings determine rulers, events, and outcomes. And they are the principalities and powers that rule. And that's why we can't blame God for the mess. And just look at Daniel. It gives you a glimpse into that spirit world and one spirit resisting the representative, angelic representatives from God. They don't want to give up their power. They don't want to allow something to take place. And there's some conflict there. And I don't know how that works with angels, but there is obviously a conflict there. If we were able to see the finger of God in human history, what would we see? We would be noting time and again how God saved the situation here and there throughout history. And we would note that in most cases, God is saving humanity through his occasional interventions. And God has intervened to save the world and keep it from being destroyed. Let's go to John chapter 12. John chapter 12. And we see free will in action. John chapter 12, beginning in verse 23. John chapter 12, verse 23. But Jesus answered them and said, saying, the hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. This is at the end of Christ's life, and he's going to be crucified. Most assuredly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. He who loves his life will lose it. And he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, let him follow me, and where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, him my Father will honor. And it goes on in verse 27. Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? My Father, save me from this hour? But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. So Jesus is a man here. He's flesh and blood. And he's saying, I'm not looking forward to what's coming. I'm not looking forward to this at all. But what am I to say? God, our plan doesn't work. No, that's why I came, to fulfill this thing. And what is that discussion? It's a debate in his mind as a human being. There's no question that he's going to follow this through, but as a human being, he's recognizing this is going to hurt. This is going to be painful. And is there another way? This is going to be hard, but I am going to go through with it because God wants me to. So God tells him he's going to glorify it again. Verse 29 says, "Therefore the people who stood by and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said, an angel has spoken to him. And Jesus answered and said, this voice did not come because of me, but for your sake. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself." The plan accomplished without free will, without interfering with free will. The present ruler of this age is interfering with human beings and their free will. And God commands and then says, choose. And Satan entices to go the other way. And what does God want for man? He wants him to choose the right path. But he still gives him a choice. Satan says, don't choose, just do what I'm inspiring you to do. Let me tell you why this is good for you. So as you think about this, what have we covered so far? This gives us a few premises to build on. The first premise is this. God is the creator and sovereign ruler of all humanity. He is the ultimate good and love. So first point is, God is the creator and sovereign ruler of all humanity, and his will is the ultimate good and love. The second point is, God created human beings with the ability to choose good and evil, free will. And he then allowed Satan to tempt human beings with evil. Satan is the one who introduces evil. So God created human beings with the ability to choose good and evil, to have free will. He then allowed Satan to tempt human beings with evil. Once human beings decided to choose good and evil, Satan became a temporary ruler of the world. And he rules the world. You know, as you look at some of the despicable rulers who have reigned throughout man's history, God did not choose all of them and put them into place. He allowed them to rule, but he didn't place them there necessarily. Some he did. For instance, Cyrus. God said Cyrus would rule. And just spoke of him by name. As many of the rulers, God didn't put them in place at all. And Satan is the present god of this world, and he's manipulating all he can for his evil purpose. The next point is, when God allowed human beings to be exposed to evil, he knew they would exercise their free will to choose good and evil. No surprise to God. He already had a plan in place to save humanity from the effects of evil. He knew when they were exposed to evil, because they were flesh, it's easier to go that way. It's easier to give in to the flesh. The way of evil and self and get is the easier way than to say, you know what, I'm going to go God's way. If you haven't noticed, God's way is not the way of this world. And that's why it's hard. That's why it's hard. The sixth point here is, God is carrying out his plan in human history without interfering with free will. God is allowing things to go forward and to play out, but he's not going to stop free will. Man is going to make his own choices. I think a good illustration of that is Pharaoh. It says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So you think that God's reaching down there to influence Pharaoh to make the choices. Is that the case? Yes, it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart. But what you have to realize, Pharaoh had a hard heart on his own. He had a hard heart on his own. And so when the plagues came, he had a hard heart. He's a prideful, selfish, you know, he thinks he's exalted and great. He's similar to Nebuchadnezzar. That same spirit is influencing the situation there. And so when Moses shows up and Moses throws his rod down, and the other magicians throw their rods down, they're thinking, what's the big deal? You know, you can do that, so can my magicians. Big deal. Doesn't matter that your rod ate all the rest of them. But that didn't, you know, he was not deterred in the least. And then when you turn water to blood, his magicians were able to do the same thing. You got nothing, Moses. That's a magic trick. These guys can do that too. What's the big deal? And then, as the plagues intensified, his magicians could not duplicate them. And they came to see, wait a minute, even we are going to have to admit there's a power higher than our power, and this power is way beyond anything we can do. But what happened was, as the plagues came and made the Pharaoh miserable and the rest of the Egyptians miserable, and they would go on long enough to where everybody's miserable and he would relent. And he would say, Moses, please ask God to back off. So what would happen? Moses would cry out to God. God would give them relief from the plague. And what happened to Pharaoh? No more pressure. No more plague. Everything's good. So guess what? You go right back to the default mode, which is hardness of heart, pride, self. So he hardened his own heart. So when people will tend to be repentant, you know, like every person, most people that get caught for some criminal activity, you get nailed by the police, they're going to give you a ticket or whatever it may be. Most people are pretty repentant. I've never seen a happy camper on the side of the road as they're getting a ticket. Have you? Nobody said, boy, I got a ticket today. How great is that? They clocked my speed at 105, and I'm not only going to get a ticket, but I'm being asked to leave the car and cuffed and put into his car for the ride to the jail. Boy, nothing better. I've never seen anybody happy about that. So the point is, they all feel, but they're not repentant. And as soon as the policeman leaves and the pressure's off, they blast out of there and they're back up to 105. Or they may slow it down for a little while, but you know they're going to eventually get back up to it. I may have been a person like that. But anyway, how it is. Somebody was talking about somebody having a ponderous, velocital propensity here when we traveled. But anyway, that's another story. So anyway, we got, so you see, Satan influenced Pharaoh to have a hard heart. And it was his choice. He had a choice. He could have relented and followed through with what God wanted him to do, but he didn't want to do that. And as the pressure was off, it became easy for him to have a hard heart, even though it was doing damage to the people of Egypt. So it wasn't God. He had no free moral agency. He did. And by free moral agency, he made the choice to have a hard heart. I will not let your people go. So hopefully that gives you a better understanding of how Pharaoh operated. And when you see that, God allowed it. He had to make a choice, and he did. And he chose the way of the hardened heart. So it's quarter till, so we're going to stop there. And we'll pick up with this subject next time and look more into the subject of predestination. This gives us some overall premises. We'll finish with a little bit on the overall premises and then get into predestination next time. So thank you for your attention. Hopefully you found it profitable. Please enjoy the rest of the Sabbath day. And it's very nice. I know we were on the way back, we just thought, it's nice to be back in Texas. It's nice to come back to church and to see all of you and to get back to the normal routine. So it's good to see all of you. And as I said, have a great remainder of the Sabbath day.